It's Tuesday, April 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a tentative ceasefire begins in Yemen.
This is very important for Japan to demonstrate to the world that Japan is part of G7 and China is not.
Substance and symbolism at this year's G7 summit in Japan. Also ahead, the U.S. and India talk defense. U.S. presidential hopeful Donald Trump is upset. What's new? Women in the musical spotlight in Ivory Coast. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Both sides in Yemen's conflict have pledged to observe the latest ceasefire, which went into effect midnight Sunday, despite pockets of fighting across the country leading up to the truce. UN envoy Ismail Oud Sheikh Ahmed welcomed the development and urged the Houthi Shiite rebels and their allies and the Saudi-backed government of Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to respect the ceasefire. It is supposed to lead to peace talks that begin April 18th in Kuwait. The latest halt to the fighting that has left over 6,000 dead and created a humanitarian catastrophe in the impoverished Gulf nation was welcomed Thursday by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who met with his Saudi counterpart in Bahrain.
The United States very strongly supports the efforts of Saudi Arabia and others who have been trying to establish a cessation of hostilities in key areas with the goal of a full cessation of hostilities April 10th, and a new round of real negotiations starting on April 18th. This is something that we have worked for some period of time. We need to find a lasting political solution in order to really provide security and stability that Yemen wants and needs and that the region also deserves.
He promised nearly $140 million in new humanitarian aid to Yemen this year through the Food for Peace program. It's estimated that more than 80% of the population, more than 21 million people, now depend on humanitarian aid, including nearly 3 million displaced Yemenis. There is hope that this ceasefire will succeed where the previous ones failed. For one thing, both sides formed committees to monitor the halt to hostilities and the delivery of humanitarian aid. Regional analyst Amin Saikil told VOA's Victor Beatty another reason for optimism is the relative success of the Syrian cessation of hostilities.
That the ceasefire seems to be holding to a large extent. And I think that has also put a lot of pressure on the various warring parties in Yemen to give it a more serious go at this time. That is one reason, and I think there is also another reason. Neither side has really gained a lot of grounds against one another. I mean, the Saudi-led coalition and its support for President Hadi's government, which has been kicked out of Sana'a since 2014, has not really made an enormous inroad in terms of defeating the Houthis. And the Houthis have not lost as much ground to the Saudi-led coalition as been claimed by the Saudis, and at the same time, the cost of this war has been escalating in both human and material terms. Some 6,000 or more Yemenis have been killed, many more injured, and a lot of properties destroyed, and yet neither side has been able to inflict a heavy blow or a fatal blow to one another.
There is a humanitarian catastrophe that's ongoing in Yemen right now. More than 80% of the country's people, over 21 million, now depend on humanitarian aid.
There is a shortage of food. There is a shortage of water. There's something like half of the population of Yemen facing starvation.
Peace talks are supposed to get underway in a week's time, April 18th in Kuwait. What will be at issue?
I think the issue will be, first of all, to enforce the ceasefire. And then, of course, draw up the agenda for more important issue in terms of what the demands of the Houthis are and what the demands of the opposition. But my feeling at this point is that all the sides have come under enormous pressure from the international community, and particularly from the United States and the European Union and the United Nations and the humanitarian agencies, that they have to really do something in order to arrest this humanitarian catastrophe which is taking place in Yemen.
A resident of Yemen's capital, Sana'a, said that he's tired of the fighting and the destruction, especially without electricity, without water, and with the fear that bombardment could kill loved ones. We turn now to U.S. politics and the social media side of the campaigns. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is in the studio to tell us what people are saying online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
So, what's new?
The latest Bernie Sanders ad is trending on Facebook. One of his high-profile supporters, activist and journalist Sean King, shared the video on his Facebook page. The 30-second clip is grabbing people's attention for multiple reasons. First, it's directed by Spike Lee, who is one of the leading African-American filmmakers of our time. Second, it's targeting minority voters, which could potentially boost Sanders' popularity among black voters. His rival, leading Democrat contender Hillary Clinton, is still more popular among that demographic. They include Erica Garner, whose father died from police violence, and renowned singer Harry Belafonte, who is also an activist. Of course, Sean King is in it as well, and the last speaker in that video is Muslim American activist Linda Sarsour. Interestingly enough, King replied to one of the comments that a longer version of the clip is coming.
I see. So we'll have to see exactly what the Sanders campaign has in store. Mm-hmm. What else is trending?
North Korea is yet again a trending topic. The South Korean government said two North Korean officials defected to the South. Apparently, one man is an army officer who did espionage work in the South and stayed there, and another man is a senior diplomat who defected with his entire family. There has been a spike in the number of North Korean elites' defection to the South, and the general reaction on the South Korean media is that the numbers indicate the rapidly decreasing popularity of the Kim Jong-un regime. Jim?
Well, thank you for the analysis, G. You may follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I post as well at VOA Stevenson. And our International Edition stream is at VOA_IE. Still to come on International Edition is Donald Trump's reaction to a good showing in Colorado by his main rival. But first, the foreign ministers of the Group of Seven Industrial Democracies on Monday issued a joint declaration in Japan calling for a world without nuclear weapons. The so-called Hiroshima Declaration cited the security situations in Syria and Ukraine, as well as North Korea's repeated violations of bans on its nuclear and missile tests, as impediments to that vision. Japanese security analyst Yoichiro Sato of Ritsumeikan Asia Pacific University tells VOA the G7 ministers have already issued a statement on China's recent moves in the South China Sea.
They are collectively against China's attempt to forcefully change the status quo. It clearly refers to the land reclamation by China and deployment of missiles onto these reclaimed bases. North Korea is also a problem because there have been signs that North is testing new missiles, and they also announced that they developed a new booster for ballistic missile, which suspectedly makes improvement to North's ability to launch missiles against the U.S. mainland.
The seven ministers also discussed global issues, including the regional threats posed by China's growing presence in the South China Sea and North Korea's nuclear and missile programs.
This is a very important event for Prime Minister Abe, as China's rise has somewhat a cast shadow on Japan's regional leadership. This is very important for Japan to demonstrate to the world that Japan is part of G7 and China is not. This is also important because the visit to Hiroshima symbolizes the solidarity of the Western world, and this really contrasts last year's efforts by China and Russia to turn the 70-year anniversary of the World War II's end into some sort of propaganda to claim that both China and Russia were victors of the World War II, therefore they were entitled to take major part in the global management of international relations. So Japan is actually given the opportunity to kind of reverse that this year.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry on Monday became one of the highest-ranking American officials, along with his counterparts from Germany, Italy, Britain, Japan, Canada, and France, to visit Hiroshima, where the United States dropped the first atomic bomb to end the World War II 71 years ago. It raises expectations that President Obama will do the same in May when G7 leaders meet.
I think Kerry's visit is a kind of a testing of the water. The Japanese side hasn't really asked for an apology as such, and it's a matter of significance in the sense that this is going to be the first visit, but also it symbolizes the consolidation of the U.S.-Japan alliance.
Yoichiro Sato, who also says that a visit to Hiroshima by President Obama in his final year in office would bring his concern about nuclear proliferation full circle following his speech on the issue shortly after he took office in 2009. This is VOA.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter is visiting India to discuss increased U.S. cooperation with the South Asian nation's military. Traveling with him is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, who described Carter's events of the day and what he's been saying about President Barack Obama's upcoming meeting with his Gulf partners in the Saudi capital, Riyadh.
He actually said that the political and economic progress is very important to making the campaign against the Islamic State a success. He said that the president would be looking to ask the Gulf partners to help contribute to rebuilding Iraq, because he said that that is what is necessary to make the defeat of the Islamic State stick, he said. He also mentioned that the United States planned to help the Iraqis accelerate the military campaign as fast as they possibly could. The secretary actually spent some time on one of the aircraft carriers of the Indian fleet. And then he went and spoke to some of the troops of the USS Blue Ridge. That's part of the U.S. 7th Fleet, which is the largest Navy fleet that we have in the Asia-Pacific. He mentioned how important it was to be there and to protect the sea lanes in the Asia-Pacific region, pointing out that about 90% of all trade that's done across the globe reaches the sea at some point. So it was a very interesting day. I know that they have been talking, Secretary and his officials with him have been talking with their Indian counterparts on trading technology. There have been talks about aircraft carrier technology when he was on the aircraft carrier, because, you know, the Indians, they have an aircraft carrier that has a ramp that helps to build the seat up for the planes to go in the air. The United States, on the other hand, has this advanced technology that has a catapult that can help the airplanes get in the air faster and easier. And so the Indians are very interested. And I was speaking to an Indian official who said they are looking for a third aircraft carrier in around the time frame of 2028. So sharing this technology is very important to them.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Also in India, police have detained 5 people for questioning in connection with the temple fire in the state of Kerala that killed about 100 people and injured about 400. The massive fire erupted where thousands had gathered to witness a fireworks display being held as a part of an annual religious festival. A stampede ensued as panic spread and many were injured as they tried to flee the flames. VOA Susan Yaki hears more details from Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi.
Well, you know, the temple, which is in southern India, in the southern state of Kerala, had organized a massive fireworks display. This was to mark the start of the Hindu holy year. It was part of a week-long religious festivities. So the fireworks display began around midnight on Sunday, and it was going on for about 3 hours. Then at around 3:30 a.m., apparently one firecracker landed on a building where a massive quantity of firecrackers had been stored. There was a huge explosion, a massive fire. The building caved in, so did part of the temple, and apparently huge blocks of concrete flew all over the place. So there was this blaze, and then there was a stampede. People tried to flee the fire. Many of them were trapped inside the temple. And that's how many people, of course, succumbed to burn injuries, while others were injured due to the huge blocks of concrete which fell on them, which apparently flew into the air as far away as a kilometer.
I understand the Indian Prime Minister has visited the disaster site. What has he had to say?
The Prime Minister, of course, offered all assistance because to the state from federal funds. He visited with a team of medical experts because hospitals in the state of Kerala are overwhelmed by the huge number of victims that have come in. He went to a local hospital. He saw the victims. He met the victims there. And he offered also to fly some of them out to Delhi or Mumbai if they could not get the treatment that they needed in the state itself.
Who were these people that were detained?
Well, five people, as you said, have been detained today. They are employees of the firecracker unit, which had manufactured these firecrackers, which were stored by the temple. Apparently, some of the people at the temple trust are on the run. They are not to be found. But cases will be booked against all the people who organized this fireworks display, which actually had not been given permission. It had specifically been denied permission to hold this fireworks display because there have been similar accidents previously, though, of course, not on this scale.
Is this sort of fireworks display typical for this kind of occasion?
Absolutely. That is why I think they had asked for permission. But a lot of the residents had said that this is dangerous. This is, a difficult thing. And that's the reason why the district administration had specifically refused permission, because typically what happens is there are thousands of people who gather for this display and it becomes difficult to control and to ensure public safety.
Are any outside supplies coming in to help the injured and to help the survivors?
Well, I haven't heard of any outside help as yet, but of course the Indian Armed Forces have been also at the forefront of a huge relief and rescue efforts. They've ferried ships there. This is a coastal area. They took in helicopters to try to, and this was a small town, to try to fly out the people who were injured. They will also be taken to naval hospitals, to Air Force hospitals, because I think one of the major problems at this point of time is to actually give adequate treatment to the number of people who are injured. Many of them are very critically injured, and there are about, apparently, the latest figures tell us that it would be close to 400.
Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi, and there's much more on this story on our website at voanews.com. U.S. Republican presidential contender Donald Trump has sharply criticized the system for selecting delegates to the Republican presidential convention, that from the western state of Colorado. The frontrunner for the Republican presidential nomination lost dozens of delegates to his better-organized rival, Republican Senator Ted Cruz, in a series of Colorado conventions last week. VOA's Michael Lippin spoke with Paul Steinhauser. He's a political director of U.S. TV network NH1 for his take on Trump's reaction and next move.
Donald Trump didn't like the rules the way they were. He got out-muscled, I guess you could say, in Colorado, and out-hustled. And Donald Trump reacted pretty quickly, calling the system crooked and stacked against him. At the end of the day, it was almost, you could almost place the blame on the Trump campaign. They knew the rules that were there, and the Cruz campaign out-muscled them very strongly in Colorado and won all 34 delegates.
Well, how much sympathy is there in, Colorado and just more widely for Trump's allegation that the Colorado caucus system is unfair?
Well, and that's where Donald Trump has an advantage here, because this system right now, Colorado last year canceled their Republican caucuses, unlike a caucus or a primary where the delegates are won or lost by a popular vote to a degree. This was all 34 delegates in Colorado on the Republican side were decided by a state convention, which seems very undemocratic in a way. And that's Trump's argument that, this is the party is going against the will of the people. And that's why his argument will have some legs.
Donald Trump has been laying low for the past couple of days, which is also a little uncharacteristic of him. Why is he not doing any campaigning right now?
Yeah, he did lay low for about 4 days, and for the first time in about 4 months, Donald Trump was not on any of the Sunday talk shows. He didn't even call into one. So you really got to go back a long, long way. I think one of the reasons why there's a little restructuring going on at Trump's presidential campaign. His campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, is still at the head of the pie chart, but he's got a lot of other big players now, and one of them who's gaining more and more power was on one of the Sunday talk shows. So I think Trump wanted to lay low as kind of things were changing at his campaign, and he's got New York in his sights. We've got 8 days until the New York primary, a ton of delegates at stake. The polls suggesting Trump is right around 50%, so you're going to see a lot more of Donald Trump now.
And what about the Democratic side? They're also competing for the win in New York. How is Bernie Sanders doing in his effort to get a come-from-behind win against Hillary Clinton, who is ahead in the polls?
You're seeing on the Democratic side a lot of what you've been seeing on the Republican side for quite some time, and that is a lot of shots being fired and a lot of name-calling and allegations. That's stuff we've been used to for months on the Republican side. The Democrats, not just Bernie Sanders, but Hillary Clinton as well, kind of doing that. Bernie Sanders has won 8 out of the last 9 contests. Hillary Clinton's still way ahead when it comes to delegates, but Sanders has momentum right now. New York State, Hillary Clinton, she represented New York State for 8 years in the Senate, and she really needs to win big next Tuesday.
The New York primary is right around the corner. We'll find out what happens. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
VOA News.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. For 9 young female musicians of Ivory Coast, breaking into the male-dominated music industry wasn't easy. But their group Bellamondo is now a household name in Abidjan and booking shows abroad. Emily Yab reports from Abidjan.
The 9 women of Bellamondo win over yet another audience at this bar in Abidjan. This was the first venue to book them years ago, and they still play here weekly. Bellamondo is one of the few all-female ensembles in Ivory Coast. It all started back in 2007 when a music producer came to then-music student Prisca Alou. She says the man told her he wanted to create an all-female band to fulfill a promise he made to his late mother. He says she kept telling him he should showcase women making music, not just men. So Alou spread the word she was looking for band members and placed ads in local papers. She says parents resisted the idea. They would say they didn't send their daughter to school to have her go play guitar on the street. Being a musician was frowned upon for girls. She says in Africa, a woman's place is often seen as being either in an office or at home. That was a stereotypical image. Most of the girls Alou managed to recruit weren't professional musicians. The group spent the next 4 years learning to play their instrument. Many gave up, but 8 of them soldiered on with Alou, and the band was born. Soon they began performing together, playing covers and original songs. Their musical style is best described as variété. The band dabbles in funk, reggae, and pop music. Guitar player Clotilde Blais says many didn't believe the band would last. People will tell us that women can't make it work, that they can't get along together, she says. So we took that as a challenge. One they have met. In 2013, Bellamondo released their first album, and over the years they have performed at galas, official dinners, and on stages in Europe and West Africa. Nodding his head to the music during a live performance in Abidjan is music enthusiast Kader Nanema. He remembers the first time he saw them.
Ah ouais, j'étais surpris.
I was surprised at first, he says. A woman singing, you see that every day. But an entire band with just women playing all the instruments, that was extraordinary. I was dumbstruck, he says. The band is great and the girls are top-notch. Alou believes Bella Mondo inspired other women to push social barriers. Today, she says, when I go out, I'm proud to see young women carrying a guitar, a keyboard, or a drum around. And I know that we have played a role in this. She says, we gave other women the desire to do this, and it makes me very proud. The Bella Mondo are currently preparing their second album. Emily Yap for VOA News in Abidjan.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website, voanews.com. And we're on Twitter, at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter and our engineer, Chaz Hall. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington, and we thank you so much for joining us. Come back again and have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Navy announced this month that it had seized a ship laden with illegal weapons in the Persian Gulf that were likely bound for Houthi fighters in Yemen. It was the latest in a string of illicit weapons shipments seized in the region by naval forces and assessed by the U.S. to have originated in Iran. Distributing illegal weapons is part of a pattern of destabilizing behavior by Iran that remains a challenge for the United States and its regional allies. In testimony before Congress, Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Thomas Shannon said the United States has been encouraged by Iran's adherence so far to the commitments it had made under the nuclear deal with the P5+1, the JCPOA. But he noted that profound differences with Iran remain and continue to be addressed.
Iran's support for terrorist groups like Hezbollah, its assistance to the Assad regime in Syria, and to Houthi rebels in Yemen are at odds with core U.S. interests and pose fundamental threats to the region and beyond. That's why we have retained our sanctions related to Iran's destabilizing activities in the region, including its support for terrorism.
In addition, Undersecretary Shannon expressed concern over Iran's attempts to develop increasingly capable ballistic missile systems and said the U.S. would use all available multilateral and unilateral tools to impede the development of Iran's missile program. Iran's violations of the fundamental rights of its citizens were also cited by the undersecretary, who noted that rights-related sanctions are not subject to relief under the JCPOA, and the U.S. continues to vigorously enforce these sanctions. At a recent press conference in Bahrain, Secretary of State John Kerry urged Iran to change its destabilizing behavior. We call on Iran, said Secretary Kerry, to prove to the world it wants to be a constructive member of the international community and contribute to peace and security, and to help us end the war in Yemen, not prolong it. Help us to end the war in Syria, not intensify it. And help us to be able to change the dynamics of this region, which needs space to begin to breathe, to engage in full economic activity, put people to work, send people to school, do things other than constantly be caught up in the instability that comes with either sectarian or ideological extremism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.